understanding that the earth is sacred. Very prominent amongst the indigenous people, who are literally the voice of the earth. And therefore, when plundering invaders take over, amongst the first strategy is to silence the voice of the indigenous folks. Which emphasizes that the earth is sacred. Their understanding may not be very sophisticated. It may just be gratitude. The Gaudiya Vaishnavas have a very sophisticated understanding of the sanctity of Mother Earth. Kaviraj Goswami in Chaitanya Charitamrita quotes Krishna telling Arjuna in the Adi Purana that of all planets in the universe, the earth is most special because on the earth is the town of Vrindavan. He also quotes Vrindadevi herself, telling Purnamasi that if Krishna had not descended on the earth with Radha, then the entire creation would be utterly useless. The earth is the only planet in the universe where there exists Vrindavan, which is our only means of returning to Goloka Vrindavan, or ascending to Loka Vrindavan if we came from some other origin. There's no access to Goloka Vrindavan on any other planet in the universe. The access is only by the grace of Lord Gauranga, who is promoting the love of Vrindavan. And that opportunity does not exist on other planets. You may ascend to Vaikuntha from other planets in the universe, but there's no access to Goloka Vrindavan. And even the Vaikunthas, the grace of Lord Gauranga is quite exceptionally rare. Srila Prabhupada named this community New Vrindavan not as some arbitrary designation, but as a very specific intention for his vision for this place. It was quite spontaneous when he heard in 1968 about the opportunities for acquiring land in Appalachia that he immediately mentally moved in, gave the name in the primary mandates to live in harmony with nature. To live off the products of the earth and the cows. Brahminical culture, cow protection, and a replica of Vrindavan. And he said many times, some recorded, some not so, that this is non-different from Vrindavan. And what does that mean? First of all, what does Vrindavan mean? It's the forest of Vrindadevi, the queen of all sylvan goddesses. It's the land where everyone and everything, more than anything else, loves Krishna. And everything they do and say is an expression of that love. The cows, the humans, the sky, the air, the earth, they all love Krishna. So when Srila Prabhupada says this is non-different from Vrindavan. Well, first of all, where is Vrindavan? You know, there's a town 90 miles from Delhi, goes by the name of Vrindavan. Vrindavan is not a terrestrial designation. Where is Vrindavan? Chaitanya Charitamrita tells us that Vrindavan is all-pervading. Vrindavan is everywhere. The question is, where is Vrindavan manifest? Vrindavan is manifest where there's love for Krishna, and especially when that love for Krishna is demonstrated by living according to the will and the plan and the design of Krishna. So Krishna and Balaram. Krishna, his main emblem is the flute, which represents the cows, because when cows wander astray, as they're prone to do, cowherd boy calls him back by the sound of his flute. The cows also means us who've wandered astray. And non-different from this flute song of Krishna is the Sankirtan of Lord Gauranga, calling to everyone, wake up, come home. And Balaram holds the plow, representing the ox. Proper organic power source that, unlike the tractor, is nourishing and nurturing the earth at every step. Just consider the life of an ox compared to a tractor. Oxen are the natural byproduct, not a byproduct, they're actually more desirable in Vedic culture than the cows, because that is your power source. But they, you know, every year cows deliver calves, about half of them are oxen. And they work throughout their life. And their fuel is the grass, same as the cow. They take what is practically most useless, it's everywhere, grass, and they convert it, the cow, into the most precious substance, milk, which alone has the nutritional content to develop the finer brain tissues in the human, by which he can understand the subtleties of spiritual topics. So both the cow and the bull, they take what's most useless and produce what is most essential for humanity. Cow, mother, delivers milk. The bull, well, first of all, you have to discriminate it between a bull and an ox. Usually bulls aren't used for work, but sometimes they are, if they haven't sacrificed their procreative potential, which makes them more manageable, but then they can't reproduce. So they take what's most useless, available everywhere, grass and some grain in some cases, and produce the most precious food substance, the cow, and then the bull, or the ox, produces the grains, the staples, for the sustenance of, and of course, from the milk is derived ghee, which is essential for sacrifice. Look at the life of a tractor. It's plundering at every step, plundering the earth for iron ore to make the engine block, and then refining the iron ore into steel, iron and steel, requiring so much fuel, which is not usually firewood, usually petroleum-based. Cutting down, Srila Prabhupada said, cutting down sandalwood forests, which again are used for sacrifice for the pleasure of Krishna and the upliftment of mankind. Cutting down sandalwood forests to grow rubber trees, or whatever kind of trees they get rubber from. So even before birth, the tractor requires so much exploitation. And what goes with exploitation and plundering? Pollution. Intoxication. Then the tractor takes birth, fueled by petroleum, continuing to pollute the air, which then pollutes the water and the soil. And even at, and during its life, tractors never reproduce, as far as I've heard. Which means as soon as it dies, you just have another pile of toxic waste. And then you have to plunder to make another one. So what's wrong with this system? Modern way of life. Just one word. Everything. It's the way we live. Those who are not in that Vrindavan consciousness. Vrindavan is not a place. Vrindavan is a state of consciousness where out of love we live according to Krishna's desire and plan and arrangement, which is the most loving. Just look at nature. People, most people have some attraction to nature. And Vrindavan Das Thakur and Chaitanya Bhagavat is quite repetitive to make the point that in that one chapter in Chaitanya Bhagavat, Lord Chaitanya dancing in the mood and attire of his different energies, Bhumi, Ganga, Parvati, Radha. And the lesson he's imparting is the same. Do not disrespect my energies. Because even the so-called mundane energies have a divine face which will point us to Krishna if we're submissive and attentive. So what does nature mean? Nature is very enchanting here on earth. But what does the name mean, nature? Means Krishna's nature. And even ordinary people are eligible at times for profound experiences. And they're so overwhelmed by a display of Mother Nature. You know, it could be the undulating waves of golden ripened grain, or the multitude of springtime flowers, flocks of birds decorating the sky, the stars of the firmament, the northern lights. And sometimes a very profound experience in nature will open something inside of us and allow the inner radiance of the soul to shine forth as compassion and service attitude. And a consideration that such beauty, such wonder, such splendor could only emerge from a heart which is so filled with love that the Creator could not contain it inside himself, and so it expanded outwardly to reveal yet another face of his divine presence in nature. So when we plunder material nature, material is the Western form of mata. When you plunder material nature, as if she is separate from the Lord, and not to be seen as our mother, but as, not as a community, earth is not a, in that light, in the plundering mentality, earth is no longer a community of subjects, but a collection of commodities for the plundering of mankind to fulfill his insatiable material desires. And that is called addiction. What is the addiction of the collective world today? That we here in New Vrindavan are requested by Srila Prabhupada to be independent from. The addiction of the world today is to consumer goods. And the instant gratification that they promise, without mentioning the consequence, which is the plundering multinational corporations producing these consumer commodities, using the advertising industry to inspire us to buy things we don't want with money we don't have to impress people we don't even like. And this is what is called in today's world progress, although it is actually regressive and the pathway to hell. Hell is synonymous with intoxication. There was a bumper sticker around some time ago. How did that go? Intoxication is for those who can't handle reality? Well, it's really the other way. Reality is for those who can't handle intoxication. Intoxication means hell. It means death. And these plundering multinational corporations, unlike the cow and the bull, and much like the tractor and the other machines they utilize, are creating death and destruction at every step in the form of pollution means intoxication. And if you don't make a very determined effort, you're implicated in a system to the extent that you have to participate with the plundering economies just to survive. And that's why Srila Prabhupada emphasized here, grow your own food, depend on the bounty of nature, protect Krishna's cows, utilize Krishna's oxen. Because as the cow is the mother, the ox is the father, or the bull. What prosperity can there be in a family where the father is unemployed? What to speak of the pleasure of the Supreme Father Krishna, if we're not utilizing his gifts according to his intention? What is the clear indication of addiction? It's denial. No, I'm not addicted. I can give up my indulgence at any time. That is the voice of the addict. And when people are conceived, born, raised, and educated in the culture of denial, and you try to inform them that you're in denial, what are they going to do but deny it? But denial has two different levels. The superficial is the denial that I'm an addict. The deeper denial is who we are and why we're here. And human destiny is meant for something higher than death by intoxication. So Lord Gauranga is calling, Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, wake up. Stop killing yourself, your community, your planet. But that's no great concern to those who are in denial. It's the addiction to the culture of death, which is basically fivefold. Death of the earth by nuclearism and other forms of... Why nuclearism? Why are there tens of thousands of warheads, computer program they can point anywhere at any time towards anyone who tries to impede the flow of our consumer goods. So those nuclear warheads are just like the gun in the knives of the drug dealer to make sure that nobody's going to get in the way of my sense gratification. And of course, there's always the option that the nuclear warheads can be pointed this way if I don't get my quick fix in time and have to face the withdrawal. Death of the earth. Death of species through extinction. Death of Krishna's original plan by genetic engineering and biotechnologies. Death of the habitat for the thousands of species that are becoming extinct. And man, human species, doesn't usually realize that every one of those species has something to do with our own physical and emotional well-being until they're already extinct. And then you see the connection. Loss of habitat, the context for life. Worst of all is the loss, the death of love, which is the psychic epidemic of the time. And it really began, it didn't begin, but it became extremely aggravated in the 60s when the term love was used by the advertising industry to sell consumer commodities that promised and enhanced loving relationships. So the very concept became cheapened by its commercial use to sell products, which further aggravated the addictive mentality, which made sexual behaviors increasingly maladaptive. And thereby desecrated the whole process of creation by this institution called Planned Parenthood, which is really a slaughterhouse for the unborn, like Kamsa of Mathura or Herod of Jerusalem, the slaughter of the unborn. The womb is the first habitat. And when that is invaded, it's nothing less than an act of war. And it's not really the male. It's not the authentic male who would promote something so hideous as abortion. It's really the vacancy, where the proper male never developed. And the void is indicated by the emptiness, the internal emptiness, which mistakes patriarchy for the voice of the father. And when you misunderstand the father, you're prone to abuse the mother. And without mother, and here we're talking about Mother Earth, father, who is Krishna, is hard to get along with. So the war on the unborn is another lucrative industry, mainly for male participants who dress in white, which is supposed to symbolize purity. Like the sacrificial priest. And the absence of the sacrificial altar is replaced by the table of abortion. The sacrificial lamb is the unborn child. Has this culture reverted back to the barbaric days of human sacrifice, or worse yet still, is it abortion of the whole earth process of giving life and nurturing our consciousness to help us return back home as the purpose and goal of life? The earth is like a mirror, and she reflects upon herself through the human consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada wanted this community to be a replica of Vrindavan. And what does that mean? Especially when he says this is non-different from Vrindavan. It means Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. And when a pure devotee of Vrindavan, who carries Krishna in his heart, invokes the holy Dham to appear in a certain terrestrial region, she does so to fulfill the will of her pure devotee. And we see this very clearly in Navadvip, Mayapur. It was at Chandrasekhar's house, this same neighborhood where Lord Gauranga and Advaitacharya lived. It's right adjacent to the Yoga Peeth, the house of Chandrasekhar. Where Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati chose to perform his vow to chant a billion names for the empowerment to fulfill his mission of inaugurating the Western movement of Krishna consciousness. Like the sun appears in the east, travels westward in time, those prophecies that Krishna consciousness would, as predicted by Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, all our acharyas, that Prithivityachiyati Nagaradi Gram Sara Pachara Habimoranam, the holy name would travel to every town and village of the world. For the empowerment to fulfill that mission, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati took that vow to chant a billion names, sitting in that thatched hut with a leaky roof, holding an umbrella when it rained. And he saw himself on the banks of Radhakund. Now, in Navadvip, Radhakund and Chamakund are manifest in Vittudvip. This is Antardvip. He was seeing Radhakund and Chamakund and Govardhan before his eyes. Nobody else could see it, so they made a replica. Radhakund, Chamakund, and Govardhan, so that others could see a glimpse of his inner vision. And that, those three elements were contained in Srila Prabhupada's first instruction for this community in 1968. Name the high places Govardhan. If there are lakes, name them Radhakund, Chamakund. Why? Because Govardhan is the very emblem of self-sufficiency. Lord Gauranga, first seeing Govardhan, he echoed the glorification of Srimati Radharani. Of all devotees, this Govardhan hill is the best. Oh, my friends, this hill provides Krishna and Balaram and all their cows, calves, and cowherd friends with all their necessities, water for drinking, very soft grass, caves, fruits, flowers, and vegetables. In this way, Govardhan offers respects to the Lord. Being blessed by the touch of the lotus feet of Sri Krishna and Balaram, Govardhan Hill appears very jubilant. Now that verse is not simply talking about ordinary grass and water. The water is the overflow of love from the heart of Govardhan, the nectar of his heartfelt affection, which as it cascades down from the waterfalls and picks up the different sap emanating from the trees, imbuing the water with, you know, various nectarian flavors, which Krishna and Balaram and the gopas drink and become intoxicated and just roll on the ground in great ecstasy. This is divine intoxication, which has no toxic effects. It's not poisoning. It's not the culture of death. It's the culture of life. And Govardhan is similar to Lord Gauranga. He's praising, echoing the words of Radha, of all devotees, Govardhan Hill is the best. Because the initial source of that verse, Srimati Radharani with her friends, contemplating how can we achieve the association of Krishna? They were married at the time, bound by the conservative culture of Braj to their household duties, while the gopas are off playing with Krishna. So like a dwarf wanting to capture the moon, who is the best ally who can help us attain the association of Krishna? Who is the best of all devotees? Krishna himself, in the form of Govardhan Hill, who awards the association of Krishna. We glorify him as non-different from the Lord. We pray to him as a devotee because he fulfills all our desires. And he's a touchstone, the ultimate touchstone. Because we don't even know what we desire. Because everyone yearns more than anything to love and be loved. And Govardhan offers that gift, along with the emblems of self-sufficiency, which nourish our bodies and minds, he also nourishes our soul. So the human species is the means by which the earth reflects upon herself. What kind of image are we reflecting? The holy Dham, there's a difference between Boma Vrindavan. It's a Chintabheda Abheda Tattva. When a pure devotee invokes the holy Dham to appear, as did Rupa and Sanatan and Ramakali, they had their new Vrindavan to sustain them spiritually when they were forced into the service of the barbarian Muslim ruler, Nawab Hussein Shah, non-different from Kamsa of Mathura. No, not Kamsa, Jarasandha of Krishna Lila. They to be independent of the atrocities of that empire, they created their own new Vrindavan with Radhakund, Shyamakund, Govardhan, and Bandan Mohan Mandir. As did Srinivasacharya. After the books of the Goswamis were lost, Narottam and Shyamananda immediately wanted to commit suicide, but Srinivasacharya knew this must be some plan of the Lord. He would never allow the life works of the six Goswamis to disappear to be lost to the world. There's some plan in this. And in pursuance of that plan, he ended up the Raj Pandit of the king, Birambir Maharaj. How did Srinivas Acharya maintain his devotional standards in the palace of the king? He made that village into New Vrindavan. And gradually the king became a devotee, became his disciple, and issued a mandate that all citizens in his kingdom had to follow the four regular principles and serve Krishna. So the topic lately has been Varnashram Dharma, which is the other half of Srila Prabhupada's mission. And his only lamentation upon leaving this world that he had not succeeded in establishing that. And however mysterious Varnashram Dharma may be as far as implementing it in this age, one thing everyone agrees on is that the farm communities are the incubator by which it can grow. Because to have Daivi Varnashram, we have to be independent of the atrocities of modern day so-called culture and create our own culture, just follow the original culture called agriculture, the culture of living on earth according to her desire and Krishna's plan, which will nourish us in body, mind, and soul and help us to remember Krishna, so that at the time of departing this world, we can return to Krishna. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes, Dapa Bhuj Prabhu.
It seems that when we bring up the topic of Varnashram manifesting itself in a community, a rural community, or as we call it sometimes, a farm community, that there's this kind of abstract it's like we're going to go around and put badges on people, you know, you're a Kshatriya, you're a Brahmana, you're a Vaishya, all you over here are Sudras, and like that. So it seems like the implementation stage is artificial, I guess. And therefore it creates this kind of anxiety about why aren't we doing this? Why haven't we created this Varnashram thing? So can you address that?
Can you repeat the essence of this question?
What's the essence of your question?
We talk about Varnashram as if it's something that we're lamenting that we have not been able to do this as Prabhupada lamented. Yet to implement it seems as if we have to designate, okay, starting tomorrow we're going to identify who are the Brahmanas and who are the Kshatriyas, like that. So I see that the implementation stage is a little awkward.
Big.
Yeah, so
okay,
the bigger social dynamic, what we're calling the community. So I'm just wondering if you had some thoughts on that or insights into why it's so, seems to be a little abstract.
So the essence of Tapa Punch Prabhu's question is, am I understanding how to practically implement the manifestation of Varnashram rather than artificially just designating your caste? That also depends on independence from the corporate world, because you know, corporate world not only controls through food supply, but also medical, educational. And the educational systems of the corporate world program living entities to become cogs in the corporate wheel. So therefore, most humans don't even know what they are in terms of varnashram. And it's also very interesting that in his introduction to Bhagavad Gita, which is a book in itself, Srila Prabhupada says, let there be one varna, one religion, one scripture, one occupation. The one varna is Krishna Bhakta. The one occupation is devotional service. The one scripture is Bhagavad Gita. So he's ekavarna. He's saying in his introduction, let there be ekavarna, one varna. While he's all throughout his books promoting varnashram dharma. So the prime ingredient is Krishna Bhakti. Now, back to that culture of denial, or the culture of, you know, well, yeah, denial. When when parents bring children into this world and they're trying to prepare and educate them to be that cog in the corporate wheel, they're programmed right from birth with a designation which is artificial in most cases. So they don't even know who they are. Even in the external sense of varna and ashram, or just keep it with varna, most humans don't know what varna they fit. Because they're so confused by the programming of the corporate world, they have an identity crisis. Now, in devotional service, and you see it like in a bhakta program, everybody's pretty much the same in the beginning. You teach them how to dress and act and talk, and they're all pretty much the same. But as they actually advance in Krishna consciousness, the oneness becomes variegatedness. The actual individual nature begins to blossom as they become Krishna conscious. And from the awakening of their true identity of Krishna Bhakta, then their relative propensities of varna gradually manifest as they come out of that cloud of illusion of the educational institutions of this world. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada wanted Gurukula. Because in the varnashram culture, and there's that samskara, when a child is offered the grains, the gold, and the book to see his propensity. Lord Gauranga went through this, and he went right for the book. It was the Bhagavatam, and he held it. He embraced it to his heart. He said, oh, he'll be a preacher. They didn't quite catch that he's the personification of the Bhagavatam, but anyway, in varnashram culture, the parents' interest is to see the psychophysical nature of the child at that samskara, but based on which of the choices he picks, and then they train him. Now, Srila Prabhupada says there's training needed for brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas. He said for shudras there's no training, but he's talking about spiritual training. Shudras, are also very elevated beings, because not only are they part of the Varnashram system trying to please Krishna, but they're also gifted in various crafts and skills. So anyway, back to the essence of your question is how to begin implementing Varnashram. First of all, create that freedom, that independence from the educational institutions that program you. I mean, you're programmed before birth by your parents. And, you know, after birth, it's aggravated. In the Varnashram system, the parents and the elders look for indications, especially by the choice the child makes, that samskara, and then they give them all facility and encouragement. And what are samskaras really? It's the rite of entry into new stages of life, at which everyone comes and encourages the child, well, child to begin with, and throughout all stages, until death and after death, encouraging through the various stages of life, including after death. So create that independence from the educational institutions which program a child to fit a particular mold, and let his own God-given propensities manifest themselves, and when they do, encourage, facilitate, and empower that. So, for all parents, I request you don't try to force your children into a particular mold. You know, Srila Prabhupada says a mother's love is the most pure form of affection in this world, but still she has some ambitions that maybe my child will be a high court judge, because, you know, the mother's naturally going to benefit materially from that. But real affection means let the child reveal his or her natural spiritual gifts in whatever varna, facilitate, encourage, educate, and empower that. Does that answer your question?
Can I add part two?
Please do.
Okay. I was listening to Srila Prabhupada, the room conversation, in which the devotees were asking the question, how is it that we initiate the old system within ISKCON was that after 6 months, on the recommendation of the temple president, one takes, one is offered diksha initiation, first initiation. And in the old ISKCON, the senior devotees who grew up in, there was kind of an automatic waiting period of 6 months. And if in that 6 months one was demonstrating the qualities of a Brahmin in the sense of steadiness and faithfulness to the process of sadhana bhakti, they would be offered second initiation. So Prabhupada said, why, this is later in the development of this kind, this is probably 1976 or so, 75. Prabhupada said, why are we doing like that? If somebody does not show the qualities of a Brahmin, why are we automatically doing like this? So in the pyramid of human society, if 5% of the population is actually ecumenical, and then another smaller, or large, slightly larger percentage, actually Kshatriya, and a slightly larger percentage has the Vaishya tendencies. As it relates to a community like this, what is the activity that is binding us to the community as a Varnashram although in its infantile stage, but binding us to the land. In other words, even in Krishna Lila, what were most of the people actually doing? I mean, when we read about classic Varnashram, it seems to me that the backdrop was agriculture. And then you had your Vaishyas, you had fewer Kshatriyas, and even fewer Brahmins.
Well, the model for life is Krishna's Lila. What were most of the people in Krishna's association? Gopas and gopis, Vaishyas. And even Nanda Maharaj, title Maharaj means great king, he's the king of the cow, he's a cowherd, king of the cowherds. So he's a Vaishya. The king is a Vaishya. There is exceptions. Madhu Mangal was a Brahmana. But he's not from Braj, he's from Avantipura. So, really the essence of Varnashram, because Varnashram means the culture dedicated to serving and pleasing Krishna, the essence of that is Krishna Lila. Who did Krishna choose to take birth and live and play with? The Vaishyas. Primarily. So that's the model for healthy society. But even in a Vaishya culture, the growers are predominantly Shudras. It's the Vaishyas who envision, production, how to make a sensible economic solution out of agriculture and cow protection. They have that vision, when to plant the crops and how to distribute and make it economically viable. That's the Vaishyas. The Shudras are doing the work. But Krishna and Balaram really emphasize connection with the cows and the land by the flute in Krishna's hands and the plow and over Balaram's shoulders. Thank you.
Mars, the point you made about being intoxicated. The nature of intoxication is that when one can become intoxicated, they forget who they are or they put that aside. But then when one becomes addicted to the intoxication, then they actually have a very strong identity. Their goal of life is to pursue that particular pleasure. To the point where nothing else matters. So in relationship to consumerism as an addiction or as an intoxication, the question would be the question always is when it comes to addiction is how to break the addiction. Generally, people are advised to not cold turkey or cold turkey and be giving it up completely overnight. that doesn't always prove that successful. It could be even be harmful. What hope does society have to overcome this addiction to the intoxication produced by consuming goods? So now it's even easier. It's easier than ever because of the proliferation of online purchasing, and it's just the drugs are everywhere. The drugs are everywhere now.
Or just take somebody's
cell
phone away and see the digital detox crisis they undergo. Anyway, Madhuri wants to know the essence of your question
for the record. Recording,
you're recording?
Yes.
It's on your scrub.
Glad I didn't know that beforehand. Essence of your question again, please. Oh, you're talking about the identity forming around the addiction, and therefore, how to address addiction when the person's identity is so formed by that addiction. And then, you know, even when you're counseling an addict, the person's not responding, it's the substance responding to the counsel. If it goes untreated, the turnaround point in the life of an addict usually comes when they're confronted with imminent death if they don't change their ways. And even then it's oftentimes too late. First of all, you know, don't look down on addicts as some weakness, because oftentimes they're the more sensitive souls in society who just can't handle the insanity of modern life. But there again, is it that intoxication is for those who can't handle reality, or is reality for those who can't handle intoxication? When you realize that intoxication is death and it is hell, there again, the two levels of denial. The superficial level of denial is, I'm not an addict. The deeper denial is the denial of who I am and why I'm here. If you address that level of the human being and help him pursue what he's seeking in the higher taste, what is it we want more than anything else? It's so obvious. We want to love and be loved. And the anguish of not finding that in this world, the emptiness of, you could call it orphanism. We're disconnected from the earth. We're disconnected from mother, from father. We're orphans. And that is a very painful condition, very painful identity. And you'll reach for anything to fill the void and dull the pain. But when it's acknowledged, you do have a loving father and mother, and you're part of a potentially loving community. That gives hope. And if that hope is cultivated, it will fructify in a higher taste. So, you know, why a farm community is so important, when everything there is in Srila Prabhupada's books and distributing them should be the first priority? Because when you read the books, what kind of lifestyle does it promote? It may not be farm life, but it's definitely promoting varnashram, which necessitates farm communities. And, you know, my favorite example of Mangachi, the hometown of Vrindavan Das Thakur, Navadvip, the Gaudiya Math jail, where the Gaudiya Math would send all their problem cases, just like ISKCON used to send their problem cases to New Vrindavan. Now, there may have been some incentive just to become, you know, rid of them, but there was hopefully some incentive that they could blossom, which they did. And that's why Gaudiya Math sent their problem cases to Mamgachi so they could flourish. Why? superficial reason, it's a village setting. So the devotees would be engaged in agriculture and cow protection, which is so nurturing. The deeper reason is it's the hometown of Vrindavan Das Thakur, Lord Nityananda's final disciple, who, like the youngest son, is the object of special affection from the father, which in this case was Lord Nityananda. There again, a similarity here in New Vrindavan. Amongst the problem cases of ISKCON, you know, some actually flourished here by the influence of the cows and the land. But the other correlation is Srila Prabhupada was clearly Nityananda of Esh, and this community was very dear to him. He was living in this house in 74. We had a garden right outside that window. Wasn't it? No, it was...
The house was up there.
Yeah, the house was up the road. And it was... I think we turned it around on the way down.
Yeah.
So it would be... Anyway, right outside the door was the garden.
And just a point of information, the reason this house is here is because Maharaj moved it. He picked it up and actually brought it here.
Well, I also lived here just before Srila Prabhupada moved in. So when he moved in, we moved out. And his cook was taking bhoga from our garden, supplemented by Yudhisthira's gifts from... Well, he was here. This house was up there. So he was bringing the gifts from his cow and garden up there. And then, so Srila Prabhupada was eating bhoga from the garden right outside the door here, supplemented by Yudhisthira's gifts from the garden of the cows here. And we were eavesdropping as he took prasadam. And he said, "This should be the standard, that your garden is right outside your door. You pick fresh, offer to Krishna, and take his remnants. This should be the standard," he said. And, Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's commentary on Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yame Bhakti Pratiti. It's a sequence from seed to leaf to flower to fruit. If every stage is performed with love and devotion, if one offers a leaf, flower, fruit, or water with devotion, the Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is emphasizing every step from seed to sustenance with devotion. And why? Because that helps us to remember Krishna. Not just with our heads, but with our hearts. Because we're living according to Krishna's plan and design. And that makes Krishna consciousness very natural.
Reflecting on your answer, on your point last week in relationship to the question, was that the real reason Prabhupada was going to Gita Nagari to demonstrate Mahashram, not the technique of, you know, growing potatoes and things in the land, you know, technique of growing food, but it was a higher principle. Could you explain that?
You know, Srila Prabhupada's choice of words is always so astute. So the way he said it, "I want to go there and sit down and teach how to," I'm not sure the exact...
He said, "Sit down and live on the land."
Sit down and live on the land.
He also said,
which is...
"I want to go to that Pennsylvania farm because they have solved the most important problem, the food problem."
Yeah. But the way, the fact that he would say, sit down and live off the, you know, everybody knows that living off the land is not an idle occupation. So he was addressing the mentality and the mood to teach how to be satisfied with nature's gifts and your natural destiny, which is much higher than dying by intoxication. And last time, you know, we were talking about different, you know, we always emphasize ox power, but we did some calculations last week. If you want to take an ox cart to Moundsville, better bring your camping gear with you. If you're in a hurry, take a horse. And when Srila Prabhupada heard about the Agashura Road, you know, when he heard about Old Vrindavan, well, how do you get there? He said, well, you know, it's this Agashura Road. Now, for those who don't know the reason, you know, most people think it was a windy road, which it was, but the deeper meaning was it would swallow cars and trucks and tractors and even horses. You know, there was a certain point in the road, and these horses, you know, their shoulders were this high over my head, and at a certain point, they would just disappear, only from the neck up, out of the mud. And then the driver of the wagon knows that as soon as they reappear, the wagon's going to disappear. It would just swallow. So Srila Prabhupada asked, how do you get there? And Hayagriva said, well, you know, you have your choice between a jeep and a horse wagon. Horse. They're the most beautiful animal, he said. And they're so pleasant to be around. And then I only know of three drawings that Srila Prabhupada penned with his own hand. It was the Rath cart, it was the Prabhupada house, and it was the horse and cart with handwritten instructions how to load. So, if you're going to Moundsville by ox cart, bring your camping equipment with you, but if you know, go by horse. But if you have to go out in the forest or the mountains at night, where there's bears and mountain lions, what animal will protect his rider from bears and mountain lions? Mule. You know, you see donkeys out in fields of sheep. Why? To protect them. Strong protective instinct from coyotes. But if the predators get bigger, like wolves and mountain lions and bears, a mule will take them on to protect his master. So, it's, you know, when you talk about these different sources of animal power, it's not just the power. There's other benefits that come from natural living and natural power sources. But what's, you know, this is all practical. What's this spiritual significance? That Krishna designed a system to accommodate all needs of mankind. Natural system. And you live in harmony with that system, and remembering Krishna becomes a very natural affair. Anything else? Yes.
Seems like the community. The emphasis has been on tourism. you see, and we kind of haven't really developed the agricultural side of things.
Well, we did in the early days, but it got sacrificed for the other.
Do you see, moving forward, there being any conflict between trying to develop the agricultural side of the community and also maintaining the tourist side?
Well, first of all, tourism would be a natural outcome, natural outgrowth of an actual agricultural community. We saw that in the old days, you know. Amish country has become a big, you know, tourist attraction because of the lifestyle. New Vrindavan was initially a tourist attraction because of the lifestyle. Because when we were living off the land, it attracted a lot of people. And they were the kind of people who wouldn't come to it. They wouldn't be likely to show up in a city temple. And the lifestyle dissipated that culture shock and facilitated wanting them to understand, you know, what are we all about? And then you take them to the temple, and they actually have some interest. And so anyway, tourism would be a natural outcome of an agricultural community, and it was when it was an agricultural community, that the tourism got ahead of the agriculture is all right, because, you know, an agrarian revolution is not going to come from the top down. It's most likely going to come by empowering the individuals to turn back to the land and develop a taste for that relationship with the earth and the gifts of the earth. And when those who are promoting the tourism see that that's actually the, beneficial to their cause, they should naturally go together. Plus, you know, when tourists come, you know, normally when tourists go to a village or agricultural community, they're looking for the jams and the jellies and the natural cottage industries and gifts of the earth and how they're prepared lovingly by the hands of those residents. It would be a big, I mean, it was in the past, and it always will be a big boost to the tourism. But not just in numbers. You could have a deeper effect on the tourists and help them become actual pilgrims by demonstrating a lifestyle that's actually inspiring to them. And we had that in the past. And we can have that again for the future if we just establish that intention and direct whatever lives are inclined and empower them. Not just with the practical details, which Thapa Poonch Prabhu is so graciously integrating with the spiritual significance, we can give our tourists something much more than what they bargained for if we just return to our roots.
I think one of the questions that we have to address, I'm hoping you could address, is that it seems in the, that there's kind of two ways to do that. One is that the institution, which, forgive this word, claims ownership over everything, every square inch belongs to the institution, that they're either they're going to drive that connection to the land and the attractive force of bringing that people come because they want to see those things, or the second option is that devotees have individual projects that begin working as a network in spite of what the institution is doing with tourism. Not against their interest, of course, but if you just take a survey in the room here of devotees who have amazing projects that are going on, either gardens or Raghavendra Mudra, you're doing your high top? It's coming?
Yeah, sometime. This summer, spring.
And Moksha has a nice idea about the permaculture area, the Garden Seven Gates, and so I guess I'm trying to point this into a question. So, should we hope that the institution supports that, facilitates that, or kind of go up independently and perform so nicely in our networking that the real New Vrindavan, land-based New Vrindavan, the agrarian New Vrindavan, which is what's supposed to actually draw people here, is becomes manifest.
That was obviously a rhetorical question because you know the answer very well. And you're implementing it very well also. It's not going to come from the institution at this point. When individuals who own land and use that land as stewards, stewardship is it's a sacred concept. It means we don't claim either ownership or control. It's Krishna's land, and he's granted us stewardship to use according to his intention, plan, and desire. So you can't expect the institution to do that at this point. We can hope that by individuals who have their own gardens and then develop a synergy between themselves and display the quality of relationships that are holistic, then the institution at some point will take interest and see that these dynamics could and should work together, and hopefully and prayerfully they'll have a change of heart in time by that approach.
How do you see Radha Gopinath Temple fitting into that equation? How is it? Some people are saying, oh, it's competition with Radha Vrindavan Chandra. They have this kind of idea like that.
Well, the way I see it is related to Srila Prabhupada's comment when he said that Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra are the most beautiful deities. And then he said the same thing about Sri Sri Landanishwara. And somebody said, well, you know, you said that about Radha Vrindavan Chandra, but now you're saying it about London. He said, the Radha Vrindavan Chandra are country beauty. Sri Sri Landanishwara are city beauty. Well, in the passage of time, Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra become city beauty, and Radha Gopinath are the country beauty. And to be on the peak of that hill, overlooking the Garden of Seven Gates, was an inspiration for earthlings to develop a relationship that is less ritualistic than that with the city beauty, and experience the wholesome exchange of taking what you've grown with your own hands and offering it to the Lord to receive his prasad, which means grace. You can say mercy, but it's really grace. Mercy means you're shielded from some punishment you deserve. Grace means unwarranted favor. So that also helps to see the connection between land, cows, and Krishna. And Srila Prabhupada emphasized that in that unrecorded spontaneous darshan at Bahulaban. Most of you have probably heard about it before, maybe some haven't. When Srila Prabhupada emerged at the border of the hayfield, which also had gardens and orchards adjacent to it. So the only audience was the Vaishyas, an overlapping of the plow department and the cowherd folks. Because apparently he came from the barn because he was followed by the cowherd folks, headed by Ambarish. But when he entered into the meadow, that's where the plow department was working. So the plow department and the cow department all trailed behind Srila Prabhupada, who seemed kind of lost in his own thoughts as he was chanting, and at a certain point he stopped and turned around and saw this most ragtag entourage following him. You know, the plow department boys had their big boots, and the cowherd ladies had saris that were decorated with patterns made from cow dung stain. And when Srila Prabhupada looked at this group, he just beamed with pleasure. And he commented that these devotees are not very opulent, but they're jolly. And as soon as he said jolly, he just beamed all the more. And then he continued, this time more aware of his following, and stopped right in the very middle of that meadow. And the devotees formed a semicircle around him, and some of us had some agenda that we wanted to address with Srila Prabhupada in confidence, and he interrupted our thoughts with this beautiful statement. You now predicate this statement by us being fully convinced that we're the most fortunate souls in all of ISKCON. So Srila Prabhupada addressed us, you don't know how fortunate you are. And he said, why? Because you have the land, the cows, Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra. And then he repeated, you don't know how fortunate you are. So we were thinking that we're convinced that we're the most fortunate. And Srila Prabhupada is emphasizing, you don't even know how fortunate you are. And he qualified, why? Because you have the land, the cows, Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chandra. Anyway, Radha Vrindavan Chandra had become city beauty now. Radha Gopinath have taken over the country beauty features and are awaiting the completion of their temple overlooking the Garden of Seven Gates, which is Thapa Punj Prabhu's way of emphasizing the seven temples emerge through the gateway of agriculture.
Actually, at one point we talked about putting a temple at the very, very top as part of the one of the seven temples, and that the agriculture in an orbit around that would just kind of develop, but in a rural way, not retracted.
Well, for those who don't know, New Vrindavan was three villages with the temple in the center, the barn adjacent, the gardens, the meadows, the fields, and the orchards all going out like concentric circles. And that accentuates the synergy, that kind of arrangement. And it facilitates the development of Varnashram because you have the practice. And then you watch where people choose to take up residence. It's with like-minded souls in an area that complements their varna. And then when people are living on the land, you don't have all this expense of a deer fence, because a dog will naturally come and volunteer services at the door of a farmer. And they're designed by Krishna for protection against, it's not just deer, it's groundhogs, coons, possums. And a good dog, he'll take care of all of them. But he'll only volunteer if there's a man living there. And then when you get the bigger animals, like coyotes, and they get a donkey for protection, and your predators take on the stature of mountain lions and bears, that's where you see the protective instinct of a mule in protecting his master. Now this is all very interesting, but what's the point? To see how Krishna has designed each one of the 8,400,000 of species of life to work together to facilitate his plan, that they all become Krishna conscious and go home in due course of time. That is the destiny that Krishna has designed for us, and it would be such a shortcoming to die of intoxication, meaning addicted to the corporate world and the consumer goods and their false promises. Anything else?
You said at the beginning that the indigenous people have a lot of wisdom in this, how to live with the land in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. It's beneficial to consciousness. I'm really motivated by indigenous cultures personally. And there's a documentary called The Time of the Sixth Sun, which is based on indigenous philosophy all around the world. So it's not one particular indigenous culture's philosophy, but many indigenous cultures' philosophies that are shown in the documentary to be really the same. And I'd just like to touch on that, this philosophy of that the white tribe, what they call the white tribe, you know, the four tribes, white tribe, red tribe, yellow tribe, and black tribe. And the white tribe kind of lost their way and got distracted with their dream and with their tools.
And weapons.
And so they disconnected themselves from the land. But it's for a divine purpose. Because Mother Earth, Gaia, Mother Bhumi is transitioning in her development of consciousness. She's growing just as we grow in their philosophy. And this situation of the earth being ravaged and overtaken by one particular culture that I call capitalism is part of that transition. It was necessary. That's part of their philosophy.
Well, as we discussed the other day, there appears to be a deep-rooted rage in the heart of modern man that since the prophecy's golden age has not descended by divine means, we will instead raise it up from here below by plundering Earth's resources in our Tower of Babel or Stairway to Heaven, as it was in the case of Ravana. So yes, mankind has the vision by which the Earth reflects upon herself, and that is a dynamic, growing vision. And even you look at technology, which I'm not especially a great fan of, but it's actually incredible. The technology exploded to the point that it coincided with Srila Prabhupada's travels to the West and spreading the holy name to every town and village. That was actually facilitated by technology. So, but technology is not inherently benign. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his revealing what the different demons in Krishna Lila represent as far as the anarthas in our hearts, he says that Shalva, and here again, the wording of our acharyas is so astute. Shalva, you know, who made that fantastic airplane, which as soon as it took off, it attacked Dwarka, he said Shalva means, and listen to the wording, the deceptive nature of technology. He doesn't say technology itself. He says it's deceptive tendency. So that's what devotees should be aware of. Use it. Use everything. It's also quite interesting that Srila Prabhupada defined Yukta Vairagya differently here for New Vrindavan than he did for the rest of the world. For the rest of the world, Srila Prabhupada said, Yukta Vairagya means to utilize everything and reject nothing that can be used in Krishna's service. Here in New Vrindavan, he gave a very different definition, which is actually consistent on a deeper level. His definition for Yukta Vairagya here in New Vrindavan was plain living and high thinking. So yes, it's all part of a divine plan, ultimately. And in divine arrangements, everything ends in bliss, despite the horrors that the indigenous folks had to undergo, which the white man will too in time. So the earth is not only our collective body, she's our collective psyche. And that's not a static consciousness, it's dynamic. Expanding for the fulfillment of that prophesied golden age, which is actually what Srila Prabhupada was talking about when he said Eko Varna. He's talking about the golden age. One Varna. Krishna Bhakta. That's not to deny Varnashram Dharma, it's to qualify it. That statement he made was, and he said, it is said that there will be a golden age. And then he describes it. Eko Varna, one Varna, one occupation, one identity, one scripture. And one mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Hare. So for anybody who's falling asleep, Sharira Vija Jada Tendriyate Kala Jivete Devi Sanyasi, Hare Devayate.